So last week we covered, let's see, Genesis 1, 1 through 5. We discussed the presence of Christ in the very opening verses of the Bible, that in the beginning Jesus was there, that he didn't first come into existence in Bethlehem, that he was there with God in the beginning. The Bible tells us that without him was not anything made that was made. And so he was there throughout all the creation. We looked at last week the beginning of time, the beginning of space, the beginning of all things. And, of course, the beginning of the heavens and the earth in verse number 1. And we saw that God made light before he made the light bearers, right? He made light before the sun, moon, and the stars. And we talked about that a little bit. And we said that the Bible clearly teaches that God is the source of light. And just as the earth was lighted without the sun, moon, and stars, that once again in eternity, the author of eternity, heaven and earth, will be lighted without the sun, moon, and stars. All those things will pass away, and the Bible tells us that there will be no need of the sun because the Son of God will be the light, right? And so we've seen that last week. And so this week we're going to just continue. I don't want to go into too much review of last week. We covered that last week. And so we're going to be continuing looking at the remaining days of creation, starting with day number 2. But before we go any further, does anyone have any questions or comments on this or the things that we've covered so far? I'd like to give an opportunity at the beginning and the ending. Of course, you all can interrupt me in between too, but that way, if you've been thinking on something throughout the week, or you forgot to ask something last week, or if you weren't here and you listened to it online or something like that, I want to give you an opportunity to make any questions or comments before we start.
I'm just thinking as you were talking about, like giving a recap, you know, all of us, like Earth and time and space and everything is created within a little space of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think how big eternity is in mm-hmm. relation to the time that creation exists, is like almost nothing.
Right.
And yet, that's the crown of the creation. Mm-hmm. You know, is the human, and it's just amazing.
Yeah. And it's hard for us to even grasp the idea of eternity, because we still try to measure eternity in time.
Yeah.
We've never existed anything outside of time, and so even with eternity, because even a lot of the songs that we sing still measure eternity in time. Talks about 10,000 years bright shining as the sun. We'll have no less days to sing God's praise. But there is no such thing as 10,000 years, because the years will be gone, right? There will just be eternity. We will exist outside of time. And I've heard it said many times that in the idea of God seeing the end from the beginning, it's because God is removed from time. And time is just it's just something that's related to the earth and creation here. And God exists outside of that. So it's just kind of like almost looking at a picture. All of human existence, all the creation, everything that's ever happened is like looking at a picture, and God can see the entire thing at one point in time. I guess a way that's kind of coming to mind to explain it a little bit. Have you ever done a panorama with your phone, with your camera? Now they've got this thing that'll do like a 360 where you can go like all the way around and it lays it out. You ever seen those? Mm-hmm. And so in order to get that, I've taken those a couple times. In order to do that, you've got to start over here. You're looking at this direction and over here, and you can only see one part of it at a time. But at the end of it, it lays it all out flat and you can see all of it at one time. Right? Mm-hmm. And so we're just looking at a part of it at a time, and God sees the whole thing. And one day we're going to be as him in that aspect, where we're going to exist outside of time as well. Now, that doesn't mean we'll be in heaven in eternity one of these days and still be seeing the things that's going on the earth right now. You know, I don't want to get weird in that. But it's just something strange for us to think about. Time will be no more.
State of existence outside of time. You know, because people will, I've heard people ask, like, no, so what are you going to do, you know, for eternity in heaven? Just praise God, and then like, you're going to do that for ever and ever and ever, but it's not going to be a ever and ever and ever because it's eternity. It's a different state of being.
Yeah, it is. It is very much so like a different state of being. And so there's a lot of people that do, and I've even been guilty of it, especially whenever I was younger and stuff, thinking, okay, I'm thinking about heaven, and I'm reading about it in the Bible, and I'm reading about angels, I'm reading about the 24 elders that fall down and worship, and I'm looking at it, I'm like, I don't know if I want to go there. For all eternity, you know, it's just everybody worshiping God, and it's just, you know, or the televised version of it where you've got angels floating around playing harps on clouds. And it looks like the picture of boredom does. And heaven is not going to be boring. I mean, it isn't going to be boring. It's going to be a place of eternal bliss. And nothing on this earth is ever going to be able to compare to it. However, we're never going to be able to grasp it. Even whenever we're looking back at creation, we're going to look at Adam and Eve, Lord willing, this evening, just briefly. But even with Adam and Eve, whenever they were first created, before sin entered in, they were quite a bit different than what our existence is today. In their unfallen state, they had quite a different existence than what we do. We try to put ourselves in the Garden of Eden when we think of Adam and Eve, don't we? But in a state outside of sin. The whole time, up until the time that they partook of the forbidden fruit, not one sinful thought, not one temptation, you know, I guess there was a temptation for the fruit, but I mean, not any kind of a turmoil, a stress, anxiety, nothing, right? No pain, no hurt, no fear, no worry. Do what?
Bullying.
Yeah, no bullying, right? None of that existed in the garden. And then on top of that, there was a unhindered relationship with God. And is that not still what we as human beings long for so much to this day? That's why Christ came and died for us, is so that we could have that relationship back. But it's still, because of our sinful state in the world which we live in, there's still that severance between us and God. We haven't fully realized our relationship with God that we will once, we will whenever we're in eternity, right? So imagine having that uninterrupted relationship with God that they had in the garden. We have no idea. I mean, that's what much of idolatry has been a result of, is man wanting God's presence with them, right? And so they try to put a visible image to it. They try to make something they can carry in their pocket. They can put up on their mantle, do something so that God's presence is with them, right? It is. And so it's like ever since the fall in the garden, man has been trying to regain what he lost in the garden. You ever think about that? I'll get a little bit ahead of myself here. But whenever God made Adam and Eve, he placed them in the garden and he told them they had dominion over the entire earth, right? He said, it's all yours. You can have anything. You can do anything. Nothing is off limits except for that one tree. It was theirs. They were honestly the rulers of the world. Until they sinned. What has man been trying to do ever since? Trying to regain it. Trying to rule the world, right? Man in his very essence and his very conscience knows what he was created for. He knows in his being what he's lost. And he's seeking that relationship with God, only possible through Christ. And he's seeking that dominion that was originally his that he lost. Does he not? And now they try to do it through their lust and their sinful ways and everything. That's how we get people such as Alexander the Great. Wasn't very great after all, but because of his conquering and everything, Alexander the Great trying to conquer the world, right? That's how we get people like Napoleon. That's how we get people like Hitler. That's how we get people like Constantine. That's how we get people like even Kim Jong-un or whatever his name is over in Korea right now. They all want to conquer the world. That's how the Muslims, they want their caliphate. They want to be able to rule over the world, right? And down through history, they have been trying for world domination, dominion, right? That Adam sold for a piece of fruit. You know that? You think about it, you go on through the book of, I know I'm getting off course a little bit, but it's interesting to think about. But you think about Jacob and Esau, for instance. Esau sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. Right? Within that birthright was going to be the seed promise that was promised to Eve and Adam, that was promised to Abraham, right? And that seed would have came down through Esau being the eldest, the firstborn. And that was part of his birthright. The Messiah would have came from his household. And he sold it for a bowl of soup. Think about it. He repeated Adam's sin, didn't he? But even bringing it down to us today, how many people are selling their eternity for a moment of pleasure on this earth? Think about how vast eternity is and how short our life is. The Bible says that our life is but a vapor. Appeareth for a little time, vanishes away. It's a piece of fruit or an apple compared to eternity, or a bowl of soup, right? And people will choose to invest everything they have in this little bit of time they have on this earth, and it will cost them all of eternity. And so, with that being said, with Adam in the beginning, and man to this day, we don't change, do we?
No. Maybe become worse.
Still making horrible decisions.
Do you think that God, you know, that knew everything? He created us and he predestined us. So, had he an idea that Adam and Eve were going to sin in the garden, that they were going to take the fruit? Was that the way he had it planned, do you think? Or was it different?
Well, that gets into a little bit more complicated conversation, because, yeah, they had free will. But we as human beings, we have a hard time separating God foreknowing things and him being the cause of it. Because we don't understand why he would do certain things knowing what the results would be. Because we as human beings, if we know what the results is going to be ahead of time, we don't do it. Right? And so if I was to make a plan that I was going to do something, I'll make it something very simple. If I was going to cook something in the kitchen, and I knew whenever I started to cook that it was going to turn out absolutely horrible, would I make it? I wouldn't make it to begin with, right? But for the most part, none of us know how it's going to turn out ahead of time, right? But God, he knew how it was going to turn out, because the Bible tells us that Jesus Christ was the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world, right? So God had made a plan ahead of time to make up for man's sin. Before he created man, he created a way for them to be redeemed, right? Before they ever sinned. But did God cause him to sin? No. Did God choose for them to do so? No. There are those who would teach that that God did, using the word that you did, that he predestined some people to heaven and some to hell. And that's not a God I want to serve. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not to mention all the Bible verses that completely contrary to that. But anyway, with that being said, God foreknew, but as you also said, he gave every man a free will. And he knew what they would do. He knew what Adam and Eve would choose. He chose to create them anyway. That's hard for us to wrap our brain around, right?
Then there'd be another two.
Yeah. But it all comes down to they had to be able to make a choice, because if they had no other choice, it wouldn't be much of a relationship with God. It wouldn't be any kind of a love relationship. I can kind of take it back to the as an illustration, the joke that's always made up of if there's only two people left alone on a desert island and the rest of the human race dependent upon them. Right? The joke always goes, well, the race would end with us. You know, I wouldn't even take you if you're the last man on the earth. You know, that kind of thing. It takes away all choices, doesn't it? However, if, indulge me for a second. If there were only two people left on the earth, one man and one woman, could that be considered a love relationship?
No, not really. No choice there.
There's no choice. It's like, well, you're the only one left, right?
You're the last one. I'm the last one, so I don't even want to choose. It's only us.
I guess in a manner of speaking, Adam and Eve was that way in the garden, but anyway, so whenever God created man, he gave him a choice. And in order for there to be a choice, there had to be the option for him to go the wrong direction, right? He had to be able to choose not to love and serve God. And we're getting ahead of ourselves to chapter 3, but still. So there had to be a choice in the matter. And God created man. He gave him a choice, knowing what choice he would choose. And then making a way for him to show himself merciful and loving to that man, even though he had rejected him, and giving him a second chance to choose him the second time around. That's pretty amazing, right? And so that starts to give us an idea of who God is. We get to start seeing his love. And we also see that his love and his sovereignty is not cheapened or lessened in any way by man's choice or his rejection. God is secure in who he is. That shouldn't be a surprise, right? That our rejection doesn't lessen his sovereignty or who he is in any way, right? And so, long way around it, he knew, he did it anyway, and I will never comprehend why. But like I've said several times, I know I've told Peter this several times as well, that if I knew everything that God knows, I would do everything just the way that God's done it. The problem is our lack in knowledge and understanding. And if I could understand everything that God does, and if I could know everything that God does, and everything that he knows, he wouldn't be much of a God, would he?
Only two gods, then.
There would be, wouldn't there?
Yeah,
and the world would be in a sad shape if I was one of them.
I'm also thinking now, you know, as a parent, I don't have children, but as a parent and having children, if you knew that this child is going to turn out a drug addict, overdose, and die that way, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of that same thing, you know, where another child may, you know, be obedient to the parents and never stray and, you know, be a joy, mm-hmm. and this one is sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but still, you know, are you going to then as a parent say, well, I've never had that child?
But that's a good illustration, good example, because any parent that's ever had children, well, I mean, you have to have children to be a parent, but anyway, any parent that's ever had children have taken a chance. Because whenever you first start out, it's a blank slate. You have no idea how it's going. You don't know how they're going to turn out. And you still choose to do it anyway. Same thing goes with marriage. And I've given this illustration before as well. Whenever you first get married, you have no promise of how that's going to turn out. You can only control one side of it, right? And I can't determine what the other person is going to do 10, 15, 20 years from now. And so because I don't know what they're going to do, because they may make decisions that I don't like, because they may do things that hurt me, do I just refrain altogether? No. And so God made a choice, and he said, I'm going to endure the pain and the hurt and the rejection so that I can show them my love and so that I can have a relationship with the ones who do want me. And that was the choice that God made.
So it's really all about God's love for us.
It is. Beginning to end, it's about his love for us. So.
It's just funny how people question every aspect of God, but what's the other option, evolution.
And to be honest with you,
what I mean is, there's not, you can refute evolution
Well, and if evolution was viable, and if it was true, okay, and all of this is here by chance circumstances, honestly, life doesn't matter. Exactly. Nothing you do matters.
Love doesn't matter.
Whenever you go to the grave, everything is gone. And it is honestly one of the most depressing things that man has ever come up with, because it nullifies their entire existence, that you may as well just forget it. You may as well just end it now, because it's meaningless. It takes away all meaning to life.
Do you think that's the way people are gone by the time they commit suicide? It must be part of it.
It can be part of it, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's such an epidemic in society today, is that man has been robbed of his purpose, and life has been emptied of it, all of its meaning and everything. Much of it is because, as I said there a little bit ago, that man has always been chasing what he lost in the garden, right? And there is an emptiness, there is a longing that he can't fill, because that longing is for God. And in the society we live in today, it tells you that God's not there. And so the one longing that is more powerful than anything, society tells you, cannot be filled. Tells you your life is meaningless, right? That God either doesn't love you, or he doesn't exist, right? And so with that, it makes things rather bleak, doesn't it? And so whenever you take eternity out of the perspective, when you take God out of the perspective, then people say, there's nothing beyond this. So look, and if life is all there is, it's not worth living. I'm just going to put an end to this and my existence will cease. Right?
What a disillusionment when they wake up dead.
That's the problem, that as one moment after they take their last breath, they realize they were wrong. Yes. But I also think it's of Satan as well, because Satan works in minds, and he tells them that's the only other way, that's the only option, right? And so I think that, I think Satan loves suicide.
Well, I also think he tells people, ah, it's not going to be so bad, you know, when you die, don't worry, you're just going to, you know, things will carry on, it'll be good, don't worry. But I mean, the Bible tells you it's appointed unto man once to die and then the judgment. Yeah. So that's it.
Yeah. No second chances on that one. But even you start reading through the accounts of demonic possession and things, what's always tied with it? Self-harm. Right? Mm-hmm. Self-harm's always attached with that. And so, anyway, I think you look at Judas, for instance. The only way that he saw out was suicide, right? He went out and hung himself. And so, takes away the meaning, takes away eternity, takes away hope. And so it makes man's existence just absolutely meaningless. So yeah, it all plays together, but it's very destructive on a man's mind, his soul. So, we went the long way around about it so far. That's okay. It's been good discussion, right? And we'll go ahead and look here if we don't have any other questions or comments. I don't want to run off from that if you all have something to say. But Genesis 1, let's look at verses 6 through 8 here. Day number 2, it says, "And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day." So this is God's second day of creation. The first day, he makes time, makes space, creates the heavens and the earth, creates the elements, all of those things, and he creates light. The second day, we find that he takes this earth that he created without form and void, and he begins giving it form. He begins shaping it as the potter does on the wheel, right? And so it says here that, of course, the Spirit of God had moved upon the face of the deep, on the water, right? And it says here that he made a separation of the water and the vapor that was there. And it says that he created a firmament, an expanse, the atmosphere, between the waters that were below and the waters that were above. And so we find here the area in which the birds run and play, right? Not run, fly and play. Where the airplanes go through the air, right? That was the area in which he made on this day. And so he separated, it says, divide the waters from the waters. And divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. Even the word there, firmament, shows us that there is something to the air that is surrounding all of us. Something more than just an empty space. Mm-hmm. That it is an actual creation there, not just a void. As men often thought that it was for many years, and now scientists know that even the atmosphere has a weight. That there is something that exists in between there, and we find it in the very first chapter here, something that science took a good while to find. And so as we look at this and separating in the parts that was there, he's starting to bring order. And like I said, he separated the upper waters and lower waters, placing the atmosphere in between both of those. And the upper waters in this appears to have been more substantial than just the clouds. And by the way, at this point in time, we read over in chapter 2 and verse 6 that it didn't rain at that point in time. The purpose of the clouds, the water cycle, right? The vapor goes up, it gathers in the clouds, and then it finally showers back down, correct? And we find in chapter 2 and verse 6 that there was a mist that came up from the ground. We find in chapter 6, I believe it is, with Noah, that up until that time, it had not rained on the earth. By the way, just getting ahead of myself again, you think about Noah, God says, water is going to fall from the sky and flood this place. And he's never seen rain before. We look at Noah and we think what faith he had to build the boat. Takes even more faith whenever you realize it had never rained before. That the earth was watered with a mist that rose up from the ground. Right? And so that lets me know as well that more than likely it's not speaking of just clouds being the waters that were on the upper part. There is a theory, and I will put that out there as just being a theory, okay? But I'm going to just look at this for just a moment here. And I'll say first of all that things that the Bible doesn't speak expressly or clearly on, I can't be dogmatic about. So I'm not taking a dogmatic approach on this. You make up your own minds. But anyway, the theory has been floated by scientists that it may refer to a vapor canopy that was surrounding the earth above the atmosphere. That the atmospheric conditions would have been much different in the days of creation than what we see now. Of course, that no longer exists, that vapor canopy or that kind of a continuous shield of vapor around the entire earth. But it would have, if that would have been what he was talking about here, what God was putting here, it would have made the earth to exist much as a large terrarium. Okay? And in doing so, that canopy would have been the source of the water of the floods. Remember, it talks about the windows of heaven were opened and the waters came down. They say that if all of the water from the atmosphere were to fall from the earth, or fall from the atmosphere to the earth, the rain shower would be very short, wouldn't last but a day or two, and that it would only bring about a few centimeters worth of water upon the earth's surface in uniform depth. Okay? It can rain locally in greater depths than that, but all of the atmosphere, all the water upon the earth, it would have only been just enough for a few centimeters. Okay? But obviously in Noah's day, there was much more water. And so the theory is that possibly this vapor canopy could have collapsed and come down and created the flood. That could have been the source of the water. Of course, we know that the fountains of the deep were broken up as well, so that water would have come from below. And there's much water that's under the earth's surface as well. But anyway, as far as the vapor canopy, this actually exists on some of the other planets. Some of the other planets do have a similar type of canopy surrounding it. And if this is what was described in Genesis 1, verses 6 through 8, it would make the earth much different. It would be a tropical climate globally. Same temperature all around the earth. And scientists have discovered that there's tropical plants under the ice caps in the North and South Poles. And so that kind of plays along with that as well. Seasons would be far less varied. Like I said already, there would be no rain. Uniform temperatures would produce no wind currents. And with there being no winds to lift the vapor up into the air with the clouds, it would just rise slightly above the Earth's surface, condense, and fall back. And that would be exactly what we see in Genesis 2:6 that I referred to earlier about the mist rising from the earth and falling back on the ground. It would be a barrier against radiation, producing longer lifespans, which we find in the early chapters of Genesis.
So the water supply would come away from under the ground, mainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead of rainwater. But also with where God put them at, whenever he put them in the garden, he put them where four rivers met.
Yeah.
So they were surrounded by waters as well. We can also see that at the time of the flood is the kind of pivotal place there whenever lifespans greatly decreased. You notice up until the flood, men lived extremely long, some of them almost 1,000 years. The flood came, and with each generation, they lived shorter and shorter amounts of time until in Abraham's day, not that many generations removed from the flood, he lived to 186, I think, and was considered an old man. And so, big difference there, and you can see steadily the ages going down after the flood, so that would kind of show us the differing conditions upon the earth. It could also produce giantism, which we can see with better conditions for growth with plants, trees, all kinds of things, right? Would have grown much larger than what they do now. Animals, especially such as reptiles and amphibians, would grow much longer. Could you imagine, you know, a snake or a lizard, if it lived 10 times as long and never stopped growing throughout its entire life? Imagine the fish. They never stop growing. Now, humans, they get to a certain size and they quit growing. Dogs, cats, horses, they get to a certain size and they quit growing, right? But plants don't. Amphibians and reptiles don't. Fish don't, right? So could you imagine what that would be like? Also, you could think with the better growing conditions, with the better environmental conditions of the time, all of the plants would have much better nutrients, nutritional value, be much healthier for a man to eat, right? We'll get into that a little bit more later, I believe, but... But all of these things kind of go together. This would have been a good explanation of what we see in the creation account and in the pre-flood accounts of the world's conditions. This could answer for that, or it may not. That may not be the way things were, but it's interesting nonetheless. Another theory that's out there is that whenever God created the heavens and the earth, everything was, all of the matter of all the universe existed in that ball of the earth. and that God stretched it out through the expanses of space, and everything started at this point and stretched out through throughout the universe, and that the waters would be placed on the outside of the universe. Don't know about that one, but that's another theory that's put out there. And since these are theories, I'm just giving a few of them. And of course, some people look at it as just simply the waters below and the waters above is the clouds and the oceans, and that everything was just the way that we see it today. Okay? Which one of those it is, or if it's something else completely different, I don't know. But what we can see from this is that the Bible says that God made it. He made it in one literal day. He made the waters below, the waters above, the atmosphere in between. And as I said last week, on day one, he created the stage for the actors of day four. On day two, which is where we're at now, he creates the actors for the stage of day five, which is the waters and the air, the fish, the birds. Okay, we'll get to that in a little bit. And then on day three, he makes the land. And day six, he makes the animals and humans. Okay? And so God made all of these things. He made it in one day. As far as the firmament goes, he made it for a purpose. He had a plan. And spoke it all into existence. So we see going on to verse number 9. Anyone have any questions on that? I know, like I said, that was a theory I went into. Do with it what you will. I'll put it that way.
I know they've done studies.
Okay.
With atmospheric pressure and all that. I've just grown different plants. And the one they grew, like these cherry tomatoes, these little tomatoes, in that conditions. And the tomatoes that they harvested from this, which usually produces a tomato like that, was this big.
Oh, wow. Just from changing atmospheric
conditions
to what you would expect under those circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And it grew, like, huge.
Kent Hovind.
I mean, it's a small plant, and it grew huge.
Kent Hovind actually shows that. He shows that they use hyperbaric conditions, that's what they call it.
Okay.
So they double the oxygen, or they put more oxygen in any case.
Mm-hmm.
And a bit more pressure.
Mm-hmm.
He was also talking about the canopy over
mm-hmm.
over the, what's the name? He was saying that would have blocked out all the harmful rays of mm-hmm. the sun, but we still would have had a temperature, a good temperature.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And it would have actually been a lot better. You know? And then obviously the oxygen on the earth would have been more, and the pressure would have been a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he says people would have grown bigger as well. That's why the Bible talks about there were giants in the earth in those mm-hmm. days. You know, there's stuff like that. It just mm-hmm. he puts a lot of those details together, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. A good different way of
give you something to think at.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What she's saying is true. You know, like the vegetables and stuff were growing a lot bigger.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that would be interesting seeing these, you know, a tomato plant that's normally gonna be. And so that also plays into, you know, what evolutionists, they find the fossils of things being so much larger than what they are now. And saying, okay, well, it's evolved in millions of years to be more and more compact. Would you consider that evolving? You're getting smaller, getting, you know. And so anyway, verse number 9. It says, "And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas." Excuse me. "And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit, after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, and herb yielding seed, after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself, after his kind, and God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the third day. And so in this passage we find the work of day three, that God started out by taking the earth that, I kind of imagine it being that the lands laid flat under the seas, and the water on top of it, and God formed the shape of the earth. And it's almost in my imagination, okay, as if he just scooped up the dirt out of the bottom of the water, piled it up in places and said, okay, we'll have land here, water over here, makes the trenches underneath the seas, he makes the mountains and the valleys and the earth. And sorry if this is a little bit, if it seems a little bit disrespectful, but I almost imagine it being like you watch a child playing with something and he's like, you know, shaping these things together, you know. And have you ever been like at the beach and you're in the water and you like scoop all the sand up together and you have the water off to either side? Mm-hmm. It's kind of what I'm picturing it as being, you know. And so God's gathering the dirt together in one place and saying, okay, here's land. And then the waters are in the other places. And so during that time, he's making the mountain ranges. He's making the valleys. He's making, you know, all of these different geographic features upon the earth. He's making the, you know, the Mariana Trench down in the middle of the ocean and all these different places. And he's forming the land in the way he wants it to be. And on that land, then he brings forth all of the fruit and all of the grass and all of the trees, all of these different things. And all of the plants that he created, he created within them a means for their perpetuity, for their continuing production. And so each of them had life, the ability to bring life from itself. And so you take that seed, and that seed brings forth another plant just like it, right? And it amazes me. I don't know if you've ever sat down, I've done this before, sat down and think about that little seed that you plant and how much comes out of that seed. And maybe I've even talked about this here before, I don't know. But you think about just that little nut. I always go to the oak tree. We've got, here, this is a good illustration. We've got an acorn.
That's false.
These are fake. But anyway, you've got that little acorn there. You push that down in the dirt, do nothing to it, add nothing to it, doesn't need any way to bring extra material, and somehow that little nut will make a mighty tree. Where does it all come from? That's just amazing to me. I would think if it was producing that huge tree out of the ground, there'd be a sinkhole underneath of it because it'd have to be like converting the dirt into a tree, right? But it doesn't. How does it work? And so it's amazing to me, but God put within that oak tree the ability for it to reproduce and have seed within itself. And the grass and the fruit trees, you know, all of these things have the ability to reproduce. And we find something interesting in this passage. It says that in verse number 11, the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind. And that seems, you know, somewhat simple. We don't really pay a whole lot of attention to it. But just those few words there, whenever it says after his kind, that the tree brought forth fruit after its kind, the seed would bring forth after its kind. It's telling us there the fixity of the species. It's telling us that God established parameters, boundaries within his creation. That the peach tree would make peach trees, right? The apple tree would make apple trees. The wheat would make more wheat. The corn would make more corn. And they stay that way. And there is certain parameters that cannot be changed. Even with today, we have so many different genetically modified vegetables and fruits and different plants, right? But there's still boundaries that they can't cross even with their genetic modifications, right? You can't combine wheat and an apple, can you? They don't mix. Now, I have had certain plants in my garden that did mix. There are certain ones that can crossbreed, but they're within that kind, that species. The weirdest one that I ever had, I had yellow courgettes, okay? They have the little crooked neck on them. I don't know if you've ever seen them here or not. I've seen the straight ones. But we had like the little crooked neck. They're big at the bottom, and they get skinny like a swan neck, and they come up like this. Yellow courgettes. And I had cucumbers. Planted them too close to one another. And I ended up with cucumbers that were large on the bottom and came up with these little crooked necks. They were cross-pollinated. But still, they were within the same kinds. Okay? However, I've never seen a courgette and a potato cross. I could plant my corn and my potatoes right side by side. Never had a problem with them crossing. Right? Mm-hmm. And so there is a fixity. There are boundaries that cannot be crossed. We're going to find later on that this reoccurs whenever he creates animals as well. Not just the plants, but the animals. And so there is fixity in species as well. You're not going to find a dog and a cat mating. Right? Not going to happen. Now you can have a mule and a horse there of the same kind, right? You get a donkey that way. Or is it the other way around? A horse and a donkey and you get a mule. Which way is it? You know more about horses than what I do. A horse and a donkey, you get a mule.
I mean, mules are...
Okay, so they're sterile.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, but still, that's all within equine. It's all within horses and that kind. But you're not going to see a horse and a cow mate. Right? And so there was a fixity there that God placed, and it's a great hurdle for evolutionists because they say that everything came from one and then all of these different areas, but it doesn't work that way. So everything reproduces after its kind. And so anyway, I won't stay on that too long, but we find that is already being put in here in day number 3. And like I said, we can see this easily observed in nature. And it is, as I just said, a huge hurdle for the evolutionist. Kind of going along that for just one moment further, though, could you imagine what would have happened in 6,000 years of creation if there was not a fixity between species? Would it not? We can see this just in, we'll take dogs for instance. Cats might be a better idea. Okay? With cats, what breed of cat are most cats? No, I believe they're a different kind altogether there. But as far as just a breed goes, because with dogs you can have different dogs. You can have a collie or a sheep dog or a Irish setter or a different Labrador and things like that. But with cats, what breed of cats do you normally see?
Ginger.
They're just cats, right?
Yeah.
What has happened with cats? There have been many different breeds, but basically they've all interbred, right? To where they're just your average domestic cat. Now, you can find breeders who have, for many generations of cat, isolated one specific type, and you'll have, your Persian or your Siamese or your Himalayan, which is actually a crossbreed between two others. Siamese and Himalayan, Siamese and Persian, I think, make you a Himalayan. Anyway, can't remember. And so anyway, for the most part, they've interbred to where they're just a mixture of everything. Dogs are prone to do the same thing because they interbreed with all different types of dogs. And you have to actually go to a breeder, someone who has isolated this type and have kept this breed pure for many, many generations. They can trace their pedigrees through the centuries, right? Because they have controlled what it bred to. Because if you don't control what a dog breeds to, every single one of them ends up with what we call a mixed breed, or what I call a mutt. Right? So, there is not fixity between breeds, but there is in a species, right? So imagine if all of creation could interbreed the way dogs do, or the way that cats do. Could you imagine our vegetables today? Nothing would be pure. Everything would have been crossbred, cross-pollinated, right? And everything would be the same. There would be no variation in food. You wouldn't have any choice between, do I want a potato? Do I want a courgette? Do I want a cucumber? Do I want a pepper? Do I? It would all just be one interbred thing. Everything would be cross-pollinated, right?
And humans wouldn't exist.
And humans wouldn't have existed. We would have already bred ourselves out, right? Because people are messed up. And so with that, you would have, out of all the animal kingdom, all the interbreeding, nothing would be one species. It would all just be mixtures. But God created fixity of kinds so that they would continue being varied. They would continue being differences between all of them, right? That's just kind of something weird to play in my mind if I start trying to cross several different animals. It's like, oh, all of them are just weird, right? But anyway, so we find this fixity of species in the plants. We'll find it in animals here on day 5 as well. Excuse me. So in day 4, verse number 14, it says, "And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for a light in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the night, or rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day." And so, as he creates the sun and the moon and the stars, we find here that since very early on in creation, that man has had a fascination with these objects. They've often been the recipients of man's worship, right? They've made idols to them, statues, places, altars to sacrifice to the sun, moon, and stars. Most different cultures that you find, you go to native cultures and things like that, you'll find that they worshiped the host of heaven, right? Mm-hmm. And here we find, though, God's plan for it, that they are functional and they are for man's benefit. You ever think about that? Man tries to worship them, but God makes them as servants to his creation. The sun, moon, and stars were servants to God's creation. He says that to rule over the day and the night, to divide the light from the darkness. Go back to verse. Verse 14. Divide the day from the night. And signs and seasons, days and years, right? They had their purpose. They had what God had intended them to be. Rule the day, the night, signs, seasons, right? We find that the wise men followed stars. It was a sign for them. How many times did God put signs in the heavens for mankind? He used the stars for it. Our seasons are determined by it, right? Days and nights are determined by it. Our years are determined by it. Even our months are determined by the moon. We're not strictly a lunar calendar, but that's where our months even come from, is from the moon. Even our hours and days, minutes, all the way down to seconds, are determined by creation. And it's determined by the sun and the moon and the stars. I forget, it's been a good while since I've read into it. But the way that they broke down time into seconds was based upon the stars as well. Something to do with, I think, the pulsars within creation. There are certain stars that pulse. And I believe that's where the seconds come from. I'd have to look and see. But anyway, They were made for man's benefit, not for man's worship. And it amazes me the effort that God put into creation, all as a testimony of himself. The Bible tells us that creation testifies of the Creator, right? And so, it is for a testimony of himself, and it is for a benefit of man. Just for consideration of the sun, the moon, the stars, how vast it is, how big creation is, what God put in place here. We can look and we can see the sun, for instance. Seems rather small to us, doesn't it, from Earth? Earth is rather big, sun's rather small. However, scientists estimate that the sun is about 100 million times bigger than the Earth. That's pretty big, isn't it? Or excuse me, not 100 million, 1 million. Sorry, I'm getting my numbers mixed up. So 1 million Earths would fit inside the sun. That's huge, isn't it? However, the sun isn't even the biggest star in our solar system. You realize that? The sun is actually a relatively small star within our solar system. And there is a star by the name of Antares that 64 million of our suns would fit into. A million of our Earths into the sun, 64 million of our suns into Antares. Okay? And then to keep going from this, 100 million of the stars Antares would fit into one of the stars of the Hercules cluster. Okay? And then several million of those huge stars in the Hercules cluster would fit inside the star Epsilon. So in a manner of speaking there, if you would take the head of a pin and place it in the middle of this room, that would be the Earth inside of the star Epsilon. That makes us pretty small, doesn't it? And that's inside the star. On top of that, look at the vast expanse of space in between each of those stars. We have a hard time thinking of the universe being as big as even one of those stars, right? But yet they're so spaced out and all perfectly synced, they don't even bump into each other. Because imagine if there was a star as big as, you know, this room and our Earth was as big as the head of a pin. How would you like that thing being flying through space toward us? That wouldn't even be a bug on the windscreen, would it? But yet God put it all in perfect order. And he did things that big. What was his purpose? To show how big he is? To show how mighty he is? How powerful that he is? I don't believe he put it out there to put other life forms on, but it all centers around Earth, doesn't it? I'm not meaning... Do what? Well, it doesn't really represent him so much as it testifies of him. For an example, you look at a painting. It doesn't represent the painter, but it tells you about him a little bit, doesn't it? It represents him, and you say, the guy who painted that has wonderful talent, doesn't he? It doesn't tell you everything about that man, but it does testify of him, right, and his abilities. Same thing goes with God's creation. With all the vastness of creation, these huge stars and the expanse in between them, it gives you an idea of how big God is, right? And how he puts everything in perfect harmony, one with the other. It shows you how good God is. If God was not good, this universe, it would be chaos. There would be no order. It would be a giant system of bumper cars, right? But everything is in sync and everything is in harmony, and that's a testimony to God's goodness. And he created all of these things as a testimony to mankind, to see all that God can do and how big God is. But then, not only that, we looked at how big he is, but if we look at how small as well, down to the most minute details. Because, you know, you think of him, this huge star, but coming down onto the small scale, if we look at the smallness of nature and we consider, if you'd take just a cubic inch of copper, now an inch is about this big, I've got to convert this for An inch is about that big. So that big cube.
2.5 centimeters.
Yeah, 2.5 centimeters cubed. Okay? That's small. Right? Any of you all ever play billiards? You know the little blue chalk that you rub on the end of it? That's about a 1-inch cube. If you would take a piece of copper that size, there is, excuse me, let me look at my notes so I get my numbers right. There are many protons in that cubic inch of copper as there are drops of water in all of the oceans combined. So could you imagine breaking that little cube of copper down into all those small parts equal to the amount of drops of water in the oceans? That's how small. The smallest details of creation. Right? That's tiny. We read the verses in the Bible where it talks about God caring for the sparrows. About even the very hairs on our head is numbered, right? He pays attention to the details. There is not a single person on this earth that he's not aware of and keeping track of. And if God is that big, if he is able to make things that huge in that small of detail, can he not take care of us? Is there anything that's going to be too hard for him in your life if he's able to do all those things? If he is able to put all of the universe into order and keep it going, can he not do that in your life as well? But how often do we think that it's too big, that it's out of his hands, that he can't do it? When you think about it that way, it's kind of dumb for us to think there that way, isn't it? God is that big, and our life is not going to present an obstacle he can't overcome. And so there's no reason for us to doubt, no reason for us to think that he can't handle the circumstances of our lives. So that brings us back to kind of the thought that we started out at the beginning. The reason that he created us, we're the object of his love, right? And he wants us to trust him. Is that not a very big illustration of reasons why we can trust him? I know as a parent, there's been times that I've tried to get my kids to trust me. You ever do that? Try to get your kids to trust you? Even on simple things. Mm-hmm. And there's been times that I've done things, even exaggerated things, just to show them that I was capable, that they could trust me. I'm looking for an illustration in my mind right now. I'm drawing a blank. But there's been times that I've done things just to show them that they could trust me, that they had nothing to worry about. Right? And God created all of this. And so much of what we look at, it's almost, I hate to use the term, but it's almost frivolous. Did he really need that many billion stars to be that big? Did that little piece of copper really need that many protons in it?
Well, I'm sure he has his reasons for making all of
them. He has reasons behind it. But I often wonder if one of those reasons isn't just to prove to us how big he is, how great he is.
All of creation testifies of God.
Yeah, all of it. And so he does these things showing us that he can be trusted, that he is in control, that he's bigger than any problem that we're ever going to face. Right? And then to bring it in all the way, getting ahead of myself a little bit again, to bring it in to where he focuses his attention on man. Right? We're not going to finish up with creation tonight. We're going to stop here. But just thinking here. He goes through all of this. He dedicates like a third of a verse to the creation of the stars, and I just went through the vastness of stars. We just looked at, what, four different ones out of the billions, and he dedicates about a third or a fourth of a verse to the creation of the stars. We get to the end of chapter number one, he creates man, and then he goes into chapter number two and spends an entire chapter talking about his creation and relationship with man. And goes from there and spends the rest of the book, not Genesis, the Bible, talking about his relationship with man. Right? Does that give you a little bit of an idea of where we fit at in his creation? I'm not saying this boastfully. I'm not saying this arrogantly. I'm saying this is how God sees us. This is God's purpose. This is God's plan in creation. It sounds kind of vain in saying this. He made it all for man. And I can say that by looking at the very scriptures. He says, here you go, Adam. Have dominion. Rule over it. I made it for you, right? Proving himself to man. It's amazing to me that God would do that. Do you ever think that God doesn't love you? That God doesn't care? That God's far away? Doesn't hear you? You ever feel that way? Think about creation. Do you think that's true? So anyway, there's you something to think about. Does anyone have any questions or comments before we close up?
There's one thing that I read here. We were talking about the canopy theory.
Okay.
But then if you look in verse 17, mm-hmm. So that's after he created the two lights and then the stars also.
Mm-hmm.
And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light to them. So he set the sun, moon, stars in mm-hmm. the firmament.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier it said that there was
water
below and above.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a whole like
mm-hmm.
water around.
Even further out. And that would go along with the other theory that was put out there as far as there being an expanse and the water being on the outside of the outside of the universe, basically. But if you go down to verse number 20 as well, 20 or is it 21? Yeah. And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And so in that the firmament can, I don't know.
That's just a different.
Yeah, all the different parts of heaven is, well, as far as where the stars and the moon and sun and all that is, referred to as firmament, but also the atmosphere on the earth is referred to separately as firmament. Because obviously the birds don't fly around in outer space.
No, there is such a thing called atmosphere and stratosphere.
Sure.
And
mm-hmm. Yeah, the different layers of it and different things. And so that's where it comes into that. There are several different theories, and we don't know what it was. We weren't there whenever it happened. There's not really any way. It does produce a lot of answers if we look at that. But we're not going to know until we get to heaven. And that's going to be interesting. I heard a preacher say this, and I like his idea, but I want to give credit anyway and say that it's not original. But just the idea that hopefully one of these days we get to heaven, there's like a heavenly TV screen up there to where you can go back and look at all these different events you wondered about. Right? You can rewind history back, and you can look, and you can watch the Israelites crossing the Red Sea, and the water goes, right? Go all the way back to the beginning whenever God says, let there be light. See the birth of creation. That'd be cool. Maybe God will let us do that in heaven. I don't know. But that's just my imagination. See if there actually was a canopy. If there wasn't, if there's water out on the outside stretches of the universe. If it's somewhere else where the water came from in the days of the flood, whenever the windows of heaven opened up, where did that come from, you know? Because God could have just created it out of the sky, right? Just rain started coming and never stopped. It doesn't have to be stored somewhere, right? Because it had to go somewhere after it was over with too, didn't it? And it's not in a canopy. So, all interesting things to think about. But it all comes back to God created it all. He made a big creation, put it all in order, and then focused on man. So, let's go ahead and go to the Lord in prayer. And next week we'll get the rest of this thing created, Lord willing. Dear Lord, we come to you today. Thank you for your many blessings, and thank you for all that you do for us. And Lord, thank you for this time in your word. And we just pray, Lord, ask you just to help these truths to sink down in our hearts, Lord. Help us, Lord, to see the vastness of creation, Lord, and the testimony of your love and care for us through it. And Lord, I just pray be with us throughout this week. Watch over us. And Lord, I just pray that you would help us to be a witness as well, just as all of your creation testifies of you, let this part of creation testify of you as well, Lord. And thank you for all you do for us. All these things we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.